Good afternoon. You're listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. I'm John Munson, in for Kathleen Dunn this week. In his book, Wrong Turn, America's Deadly Embrace of Counterinsurgency, author Colonel Jean Gentile questions the necessity and effectiveness of the doctrine of counterinsurgency. In this hour on the Kathleen Dunn program, we're going to talk about this doctrine, what it is, the history of it, what it means, how it's been employed by the United States military, and what it is that Colonel Gentile thinks is the problem. And we'll also take your calls and comments and questions as well. 800-486-8655, talk at WPR.org, or Facebook. All three channels open and waiting for you to join the discussion. First of all, let me welcome Colonel John Gentile to the At Issue program. Excuse me. You know, I knew that was going to happen once this week, to the Kathleen Dunn program. And welcome, Colonel. Thank you for joining me today.
Yeah, thanks for having me, John.
What prompted you to write this book in the first place?
Well, first, John, let me say, before I start answering questions, the views that I'm going to express here, of course, my own and not necessarily those of the Department of Defense. But to answer your question, what prompted me to write the book? Two things. I think, first of all, my experience in command of a cavalry squadron in West Baghdad in 2006, and then coming back at the end of 2006, and then staying in command at Fort Hood for another 6 months during, you know, from January to about July of 2007. And it was at that time when the surge of troops under General Petraeus started to happen. And it was also at that same time where I started to see the early sort of indicators of this counterinsurgency narrative that suggested that on the ground something very, very different was happening operationally and in terms of generalship with General Petraeus compared to what came before. And so I started to see all these things kind of happening at the same time. And it was right around then, too, when I left Fort Hood, came back to West Point to resume teaching duties. And so I really started to see a conflict in terms of what I experienced in 2006, what I perceived based on my reading, talking to people who were still there, what was actually happening in the surge, during the surge, and other things that were going on in Iraq. And then kind of the disconnect between those things and this developing counterinsurgency narrative that was also starting to build at the same time. So it was those things together that really got me interested into starting to write about these things.
And you weren't the only one asking questions about this either.
There was a few of us. Colonel Doug McGregor, a colleague and a good friend of mine, also started to question some of these things early on, as well as others. Carl Prine, an investigative journalist in Pittsburgh, Andy Basevich, and a number of others. But it seemed, at least at the time, there weren't a lot who were pushing back and questioning this developing narrative.
Well, let's back up to 6x6 for just a moment and talk about what counterinsurgency is, because it's not a new military strategy, and it wasn't always called counterinsurgency, but it's been around for thousands of years.
Sure. And boy, we could spend an entire hour talking about the history, the origins of counterinsurgency. But let me do it this way, John. Let me just explain what American counterinsurgency is, as codified or written out in the Army's counterinsurgency manual that was published in late 2006, Field Manual 3-24. And again, there are a lot of historical roots to this type of counterinsurgency, and that's one of the things that I write about in my book. And a lot of misunderstood and wrongly explained histories of this counterinsurgency. But essentially, American counterinsurgency aims to put a foreign occupying military force like the American Army on the ground in a place, in a foreign land, where an insurgency in the midst of a civil war is occurring. And the idea behind American counterinsurgency is that if the counterinsurgent army does certain things correctly, like provide the local population in cooperation with the host nation government, certain things like governance, infrastructure, an improved economy, local security forces, and at the same time, if it fights effectively the insurgents who are battling the government. The idea behind American counterinsurgency is that by providing these things, it will win the local population over to its side, and therefore the side of the government being supported, where the insurgents can easily be separated from the people and hunted down and captured or killed. That's the theory of American counterinsurgency. Whether it actually happens that way in practice, as we've tried to do it in Iraq or in Afghanistan and in history, is a very different story.
Well, I don't pretend to be a military historian or expert. I don't play one on the radio. That's why we have guests. But I do have questions. That sounds like a lot of that, what you just described.
Yeah.
Sounds more like work for the Peace Corps than for the United States Army. Forgive me for saying so, but it just doesn't seem very military.
Well, in a way, I mean, that's not a bad analogy. It's nation building at the barrel of a gun. Because if you think about it, those things that I said that according to American counterinsurgency, that the counterinsurgent force provides, builds infrastructure like roads, schools for girls, right? Those kinds of things, improves the economy by establishing a banking system, as an example, improves local and national governance, improves and builds local security forces. Those are the institutions of a modern functioning state. And the thinking behind American counterinsurgency is that if you do those things simultaneously, and they're called lines of effort, then again you will win the population over to your side. But it is armed nation building at the barrel of a gun.
Well, let's go back to something else that you talked about, though, and that counterinsurgency presupposes the existence of a civil war to which there are two sides.
Mm-hmm.
Now, let's put that in the – I'm just a bugger for context.
Mm-hmm.
If you put that in the context of what was going on in Iraq in 2006,
right.
Is that the situation that you, in fact, had?
Yes, and that was – so that was the problem – like I said, when you asked me how I got into this this whole line of work and writing and analysis, what I experienced in 2006, because my cavalry squadron was in West Baghdad, the first half of the year we were in the southwest portion of Baghdad, known as West Rashid, and then the second half of the year we were moved up into the northwest portion of western Baghdad. And for about 4 or 5 months of that remaining 6 months of 2006, my squadron concentrated in the Sunni district of Amria. So what I witnessed in 2006 on the ground was a civil war between Shia and Sunni. Now, it was supported in various ways by different sides, but the fundamental aspect to that civil war was a sectarian civil war between Shia and Sunni, and they were fighting for their lives. And so what happened was when I came back from Baghdad in late 2006, and I finally had a chance to read the newly published field manual on counterinsurgency, which said that if I do these things according to this doctrine, then therefore I should be successful, the two just didn't match up. Like, for example, in Field Manual 3-24, there is a depiction of a population that is dealing with an insurgency. And it says this. It says, in any situation, whatever the cause, there will be a population that looks like, and then it describes the population. And it says, a small percentage will be for the counterinsurgent force and the government it's supporting. Another small percentage will be dead set against the government, and they are the hardcore insurgents. But according to this doctrinal manual how it portrayed a population, the rest, that big malleable mass in the middle, who are often referred to as fence sitters, were just waiting to be won over by effective counterinsurgency tactics. Well, what I experienced in West Baghdad was no fence sitters, but a fence drawn right between the middle with Shia and Sunni on either side.
And so how then, given what the doctrine was, here you're handed this. I mean, the military is nothing if not top down in terms of its management. That's how they're set up. But you're handed this and you see the conditions on the ground aren't really what the people who wrote the manual were telling you. What do you do as a commander? How do you reconcile that doctrine with what you have in front of you?
Yeah, well, when I commanded the cavalry squadron in West Baghdad, I mean, that's one of the arguments that I make in my book, this whole notion that there was a radical transformation in operational method once General Petraeus took over in February 2007, along with a radical difference in the generalship of Petraeus relative to who came before General George Casey. I mean, that's the whole idea behind this narrative of counterinsurgency, is that there's radical discontinuity in operational method and generalship, right? One of the things I argue in my book is that's just not the case. I mean, if you look into the historical record, what you see is continuity. And not discontinuity. So when we look to see or we look for answers as to why these wars turned out the way they did, the answer is not in the tactical method of how the armies performed or the generals who commanded them. The answer is we have to look to other places like social, political context, strategy, and other things like that. So to answer your question, when I was on the ground, was Baghdad, I mean, I had a mission. It was a tactical mission to try to do these tactics, these methods of counterinsurgency, because we were doing those in 2006, and the rest of the Army, the American Army, was doing it well before. It was when I came back, when I got back to Fort Hood and had time to think and reflect, that I really saw the disconnect between the narrative that was starting to be put together surrounding General Petraeus and the surge and the reality of what I experienced in 2006 as a commanding officer in West Baghdad and my study of history of counterinsurgency warfare.
800-486-8655 is the number you can use to join the discussion. We're talking about the book, A Wrong Turn, America's Deadly Embrace of Counterinsurgency. Colonel John Gentile is my guest this hour. He's the author of the book. You're certainly welcome to join our discussion. I'm sure you have questions about this. It, I think, is a fairly controversial topic, at least for some people. We welcome your input. 800-486-8655. You can also join us via email. The address is talk@wpr.org, talk@wpr.org. And you can also post to the Kathleen Dunn Show Facebook page as well. And I'll share that post with our listening audience. So, Colonel, I want to read you a quote. I did some preparation for this. I did a little research that wasn't part of your book. I wanted to actually read as much of the field manual as I could, and I discovered there have been several updates since 2006. But I also came across something called the Small Wars Journal, and there was an article by Stephen Melton that I looked at briefly. And I just want to read you a quote from that article and have you respond to it. And he says, whether we like it or not, our experience indicates that deploying U.S. combat units to preserve the power of a foreign government against domestic insurgents is a fool's errand. How would you evaluate that?
Well, first of all, I mean, the American Army, as a serving Army colonel, the American Army is will do whatever its civilian masters tell it to do. So if our civilian masters tell us to go to this place in the world and deal with a problem of insurgency or stability, then that's exactly what we'll do. But also, I think it's the military's role, and I think that's what Steve was getting at. He was also what's interesting, when I was a tank company commander in Korea, 1991 to 1993, then I was Captain Gentile, then Major Steve Melton was my battalion S3. I think what Steve is getting at in that article, because I'm familiar with it, is a problem with strategy that says that basically tries to ask a question: what are the important American interests that are in jeopardy or at risk in a certain part of the world? What kind of national resources can be applied to protect, to achieve, obtain those national interests, and then do that in a reasonable cost in blood and treasure. And I think when Steve says it's a fool's errand, we could apply that, I think, to Afghanistan and look at American strategy in Afghanistan, where the core political objective, and I argue this in my book in Afghanistan, from the beginning, from 2001, but especially once the Taliban was removed and al-Qaeda was essentially destroyed, has been the core political objective for the United States in Afghanistan has been the destruction of al-Qaeda and preventing it from returning to Afghanistan to use it as a base to attack the United States, period. That is the core political objective. However, American strategy has sought to achieve and maintain that core political objective by putting in place a maximalist operational method of armed nation building to achieve that very, very limited core political objective, which I think could have been done at a much more limited use of American resources. And so when Steve says it's a fool's errand, I think he's basically making a criticism of American strategy when it tries to do these campaigns of nation building in different parts of the world when the political objectives maybe don't warrant that kind of supreme military effort, which are highly costly, not only for ourselves, but for the places involved.
We're going to continue our discussion. First, we'll take a little break, and hopefully some callers will want to join us at 800-486-8655. If you have questions for Colonel Gentile, now would be a great time to call in and ask him because the phones are available. 800-486-8655. Email address is talk@WPR.org. And, of course, you can always post to the Kathleen Dunn Show Facebook page. I'm John Munson, in for Kathleen Dunn this week. You're listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. This hour, I'm talking with Colonel John Gentile about his new book, Wrong Turn, America's Deadly Embrace of Counterinsurgency. And you're certainly welcome to join us at 800-486-8655. Colonel, we've spoken about Iraq. We've spoken a little bit about Afghanistan.
Right.
What did we learn? What did we learn in Vietnam that maybe has informed counterinsurgency doctrine for the Army since then?
Well, I think we learned, John. I think we learned the wrong things from Vietnam. Although those wrong things, in my view, those wrong lessons have been portrayed as the right lessons that we learned from Vietnam. I think the key lesson for the United States in Vietnam is that there are limits to what American military power can accomplish in the world. And I think the other thing that we should have learned from Vietnam is that it becomes very, very dangerous when an army, a military force, fights a war and then fights the war and evaluates itself within its own tactical and operational world and is unable really to relate that and criticize it to higher and more important questions of strategy and policy. And the United States failed, I think, at doing that in Vietnam, and I think we've made the same mistakes in Iraq and Afghanistan. Unfortunately, what seems to develop after Vietnam are lessons that are focused on tactics, whereas really is almost as soon as the war was over, but especially in the early 1980s in books like Andrew Krepinevich's The Army in Vietnam and then others that came out later was this idea that the United States lost the war in Vietnam because its army didn't understand how to fight counterinsurgency correctly, and that if it would have applied the so-called classic methods of counterinsurgency like the British supposedly did in Malaya, then or therefore it could have won the war if it had just fought the war differently on the ground by using better tactics. And in my view, that is a complete misunderstanding of why the United States failed at Vietnam. In Vietnam, it failed because it didn't understand that the war was unwinnable based on a moral and material price the American people were willing to pay. And that is fundamentally a question and a problem of strategy and policy. So the answer to Vietnam has to do with that, strategy and policy, and not how the American Army fought the war.
800-486-8655. If you're someone who served in Iraq and Afghanistan, a veteran, give us a call and maybe talk about how you experienced this doctrine as someone who was boots on the ground over there. I would like to hear your perspective. 800-486-8655. Let's go back to Afghanistan for just a moment. You devote a significant portion of your book to a discussion of it. Let's see. I just want to read a sentence here and have you talk a little bit about it.
Yeah.
This is from Chapter 5 of your book. You write, Petraeus has often been quoted, General Petraeus has often been quoted as saying that after he arrived in command, and even 1 year before with the arrival of General McChrystal in the spring of 2009, the American effort in Afghanistan had finally gotten the, quote, inputs right, end quote. What does that mean?
Right, John, that just like I said about, that's the argument that comes out after Vietnam. Again, people like Andrew Krepinevich, Army of Vietnam, John Noggle's book, Learning to Eat Soup with a Knife, then later in the 1990s, Lewis Sorley's book, A Better War, and then more recently his newly published biography of General Westmoreland. The inputs are essentially transforming, reinventing a conventionally minded army that doesn't understand how to do counterinsurgency into one that does, and then, more importantly, or probably equally as important, get the right general in charge who also understands how to do correct counterinsurgency. Have him reinvent, transform his army into doing the proper methods of counterinsurgency. And then once you have those right inputs in place, the war can be put on a path to success. Those are the essential pillars of the counterinsurgency narrative. A conventional fumbling army doesn't know how to fight the war correctly, that's transformed by, to use a term that popular historian Victor Davis Hanson uses, the savior general, who gets his army doing the tactics, the methods of counterinsurgency correctly. That's how these wars can be won. That's what the narrative says. Unfortunately, the historical record shows something very, very different, that these wars, say, for example, the ones that I write about in my book, Malaya, Vietnam, Iraq, and Afghanistan, they didn't turn on the tactical methods that the armies employed, or for that matter, really, the generalship. They turned on more important matters of strategy, policy, political, social context that surrounded the tactics and the generals that fought these wars.
Well, it's speaking of political context, how much of the strategy, the insistence on the use of the counterinsurgency strategy, do you perceive was maybe pushed a little bit by political entities?
Yeah.
The generals are given the job of fighting the war, but they're not always given the actual authority to fight it. They have to answer to somebody else, and those people don't always understand military history, tactical considerations, and they have other constituencies to answer to.
Right.
How much of that kind of thing is responsible for the counterinsurgency doctrine that we tried to employ in Iraq and Afghanistan?
Yeah, no, that's a good question. Well, I mean, first of all, I do think this is one of the problems that the United States military, especially the Army, experiences in Vietnam. And that it only gets worse at this in the years after Vietnam in the 1980s and 1990s. And that is talking about the higher levels of the American military, the interaction between high-ranking generals and policymakers. And there has been this troubling tendency, I think, for the American military to want to isolate itself in a tactical and operational world, and not have to deal with these messy issues of policy. But good strategy has to be an interaction between the two, the military and policy. And in the American democracy, ultimately the military is always subordinate, of course. But there needs to be this interaction, and I don't think that ever really took place the way it should have in Vietnam, and I certainly don't think it happened with Iraq and Afghanistan. But to your question, I think this field manual 3-24 came at a time when the war for the United States and Iraq seemed like it was lost. Although, if you look at it, there are already fundamental changes that were occurring on the ground that were pushing it into a different direction. And so this new counterinsurgency doctrine comes out, and it seems to be a recipe for turning the war around. So it appeals in one way to the military in a way that it provides at least the appearance of maybe doing something differently. I also think it was very appealing within American politics to the American liberal interventionist left, along with the neoconservative factions, especially once the narrative was built around the surge in General Petraeus, it offered up the promise that finally the American military had figured out how to do foreign wars of occupation and make them work.
Mm-hmm. We're starting to get some calls. Let's take a caller. We'll start in Sun Prairie, and Steve is with us. Steve, good afternoon. Thanks for joining us.
Hello?
Hi, Steve. Go ahead.
Hi, this is Steve. I've been calling from Sun Prairie, and I did psychological operations and special warfare during Vietnam. Mm. But when we talk about insurgencies, and I think really we should be talking about insurgencies, and we taught the British a really strong lesson in fighting an insurgency. And it seems to me that the insurgents were more like Franklin and Adams, which basically say we can afford to lose the whole army if we have to, but we will keep fighting on and we will reconstitute ourselves. And it strikes me that American generals are more like the Howell brothers, that basically they want to come in and pacify, but really do not want to take the strong steps or commit the resources, the nation building, to actually defeat a insurgency. Therefore, we seem like we've always ended up looking like the British after every intervention, being Vietnam and now in Iraq and Iran.
Right. Steve, so can I let me comment on that? I sort of chuckled because I teach military history. In fact, I direct the military history program here at West Point. The great thing about West Point is all students take 2 years of history. They take a year of history when they're freshmen or plebes, and then they take another year of history when they're seniors, and we call it the history of the military art. And I really enjoy teaching that course. And when I teach, in the first semester goes from roughly the dawn of early modern war up to the end of the Civil War. And so in the first part of that first semester, we teach probably five or six lessons on the American Revolution. And my focus, because I find it to be just the kind of interesting connection that you just made there, is to focus on the British. Because what the British face in the American Revolution is essentially a problem of strategy. And just like you said, you use the word resources. How much were the British willing to commit? What were they willing to do when they had other demands in the world, like India and other places? So it really becomes a problem of strategy. And then in the end, for the British in the American Revolution, and I think the same thing for the United States and Vietnam, just like the United States and Iraq and Afghanistan, it becomes a problem of strategic overreach, which produces a strategic mismatch, where in the end, the interests, the objectives, while important, never really seem to rise to the level of the commitment that the British made in the American Revolution, or for that matter, the United States and Vietnam, Iraq and Afghanistan.
And Steve, thanks for the call. And isn't it also, and maybe this is just saying what you said in a different way, you come to a point where it's just not worth it. And maybe there's the national will may either be paying attention to something else or just not there, was never really that interested in the first place.
Right.
And at some point, you know what, let's just cut our losses and go home. Because, I mean, if you take a look at the correlation of forces,
right,
not to use jargon, but if you take a look at Great Britain versus the colonies at that point, it should not have been a contest. This should have been a mosquito that got slapped by the crown, and yet it wasn't. And the British ended up losing, walking away from it. But was it a question of willingness to commit what was required, paying the price, whereas the colonists said, "Hey, we got no place to go. We're in this no matter what happens."
Yeah, I mean, I think just to begin to comment on what Steve and what you just said, John. I mean, I do think that with the British and the American Revolution, there may have been an opportunity earlier. I mean, Steve mentioned General Howe. If he had fought a little bit more aggressively, that may have crushed Washington's army, say, for example, at Long Island, and that may have ended the revolution, but that's a tough one. I mean, because you're really fighting against an idea, and it is really a war for the people's mind. What's interesting, I think, in these wars of empire and of colonies, and then of later times for the United States, allies in different parts of the world, is this question of strategic overreach. And then once you have overreached yourself and you've committed so much, and like, for example, you know, once the Tet Offensive happens in summer of or January 1968, and then goes on through the first half of 68, you know, the interesting and then troubling thing with Vietnam is, okay, so that's the point where the United States realizes it just ain't worth it anymore. But then it takes the United States almost another 3 years to get itself out of the war, another 20,000 Americans killed, hundreds of thousands, if not more, of Vietnamese killed during those 3 years. So the interesting, challenging historical problem is why it takes so long for a state to figure out it's hit that point of strategic overreach, and it becomes very, very difficult to end these wars. Because that's, I mean, the other thing that one starts to, when you study military history, is wars are relatively easy to get into, but they can be very, very difficult to get out of.
Mm-hmm. And again, I don't want to spend all afternoon talking about history, but
that's okay. I like talking about history, John.
Well, I was just reminded of, I did actually take a military history class from a former infantry lieutenant, World War II infantry lieutenant. That was a long time ago, and
right.
I think I forgot most of it. But let's fast forward. Let's take that American Revolution example and what happened with the British. You talked about we were fighting for an we being that portion of the colonial population,
right,
that really was involved in the revolution. It wasn't everybody.
Right.
There was
right.
They were fighting for an idea.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. So how much more powerful?
Yeah.
Because there is a religious aspect to what we've seen. You talked about it, the Sunni and the Shia. You've got a religious aspect now. How much more powerful is a religion than an idea? And how does that need to influence the thinking about something like counterinsurgency?
Right. Then that gets to, again, this gets to this problem of strategy and what you're willing to apply to achieve your goals. I make this argument in the last chapter on Afghanistan, where I say, I mean, in the book, I argue that counterinsurgency doesn't work because it's so expensive, and it costs so much that in the end, the goals that are trying to be achieved by this operational method, eventually there comes to be the realization that it's just not worth it. But actually, I mean, counterinsurgency can be made to work. I mean, the kind of counterinsurgency that I explained at the beginning of the show, American counterinsurgency, which is armed nation building. And in a way, in a hypothetical, the United States could make American counterinsurgency work in Afghanistan. But it would be, in my view, I think, and again, that would be to turn Afghanistan into a modern functioning state with the essential institutions of a modern functioning state. It would take a multi-generational effort. It would require hundreds of thousands of troops, right, to control the population, not through this, which is a part of American counterinsurgency, the idea that you can produce control by providing the population with things and then winning them over to your side. No, I mean like physical control of the population. So it would take hundreds of thousands of troops. It would probably take, like I said, a multi-generational commitment on the United States to achieve this. But then if you're doing strategy right, you would take a step back and say, well, wait a minute, what is the core political objective in all of this in the first place? It's the destruction of Al-Qaeda. So then good strategy then says we don't need to go through all of that to achieve that core political objective. It can come at a much more reduced effort.
Mm-hmm. Let's take another quick call before break. We'll go to Connie in Arcadia. Hi, Connie. Thanks for joining us today.
Hi. I just wanted to say thank you. You know, the term counterinsurgency is thrown around all the time, and I never really heard an explanation of it before, and I thank you for that. And I'm wondering, could you give some examples of where that has worked? I mean, I'm hearing you say that
I'm sorry to cut you off.
It hasn't worked at all.
I'm sorry, John. I was Connie asked, can you give examples of where this kind of counterinsurgency has worked? And I just blurted out, no. You can't find any examples where a foreign occupying power made this kind of American-style counterinsurgency work. Now, the whole counterinsurgency narrative has been premised on one important case, which is the British in Malaya, and that's what books like John Nagle, Learning the Soup of the Knife, he argues that the British did use this kind of counterinsurgency. Well, that's not how the British won or why the British won in Malaya from 1948 to 1960. They won because they resettled and physically relocated 500,000 ethnic Chinese people who were supporting the insurgents. So you can't – the only case you can find where there are elements of a foreign occupying power using this type of counterinsurgency where it worked was the American in the Philippines from 1899 to 1902. But the American Army applied this kind of counterinsurgency only in certain parts, the more peaceful parts of the Philippines, and that was only like a patchwork of a greater effort to subdue the rebellion. Now, there are plenty of examples of governments that are dealing with an insurgency in their own state using this type of counterinsurgency method to some levels of success. The Colombian government, I've read the last 3 or 4 years ago, shifted its strategy to employ these kinds of methods modeled or resembling American counterinsurgency, or the Magsaysay government in the Philippines in the 1950s used this type of counterinsurgency. But there's a big difference. Those governments aren't going anywhere, and they have an existential interest to making this kind of counterinsurgency work, and they have the time and they have the patience to carry it out.
And Connie, thank you so much.
Thank you, Connie.
Thanks for calling and for sharing your question with us. We're going to take a break, Colonel, when we come back. The fact that we can't really cite an example of success begs the question, why did we continue to pursue this strategy? I want you to talk about that a little bit when we return. We're going to take a short break. You can join us at 800-486-8655. I'm John Munson. You're listening to the Kathleen Dunn Program on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. We're talking about the book Wrong Turn, America's Deadly Embrace of Counterinsurgency, with Colonel John Gentile, the author of the book, and our guest this afternoon. You can be a part of the program, too, at 800-486-8655, talk at WPR.org, or online on Facebook. Leave a comment or question there. Connie had a question. Can you name a successful counterinsurgency? And your simple answer was no. You qualified that a little bit, but since we really can't identify a successful counterinsurgency effort, why do we continue to persist in believing that this can be done? Do we just think we haven't done it right yet, or what?
Yeah, again, there's been a lot of, in history, there's been a lot of successful counterinsurgencies or suppression of rebellions, right? I mean, there's lots of examples of even, I mean, the British were relatively or pretty successful at it in the 19th century in India and other places like that. When I say there's no example of counterinsurgency working, to answer Connie's question, I'm talking about a foreign occupying power like the United States using FM 324 hearts and minds style counterinsurgency. There's no historical cases of that kind of counterinsurgency working. But to your question, John, is to then why do we keep trying? From an American perspective, I think part of that answer rests within the American military, namely, especially the American Army. And that after the, I mean, this is the first war that the United States Army lost, the United States military overall, but it was really the American Army that fought it and bled along with the Marines on the ground, and of course, including the Air Force as well. But this idea that the war could have been won if the Army had just fought it better. And there's also a derivative of this counterinsurgency narrative that's called the better war thesis that also emerges out of Vietnam. And this derivative of the counterinsurgency narrative says that actually the United States Army turned itself around in the middle of 1968 once General Abrams, the replacement for General Westmoreland, took command. And according to the narrative, Abrams turned his army around on a dime, almost immediately, got it doing counterinsurgency correctly, and went on to actually defeat the Viet Cong in South Vietnam. And the war was lost not because the American Army lost it, but because of weak politicians in American Congress protesting college students on campuses across the country. I mean, this is all nonsense, right? But it becomes a very, very powerful argument, especially for the American Army after Vietnam, that either the war could have been won if it would have just fought it differently on the ground tactically, or again, the derivative, that it actually won the war in the South. So it becomes a very, very appealing army for at least certain parts of the American Army after Vietnam. As to its greater sort of appeal within the broader American defense and political community, again, I think counterinsurgency, when it came into its very, very public form with General Petraeus and the surge in 2007, everything seemed to point to the idea that it had worked, because violence really starts to lessen or drop by the end of 2007, and people look around and say, what happened? Why has violence dropped so precipitously? And very quickly, the answer coalesced around the idea that the American Army transformed itself to doing counterinsurgency correctly under a savior general named David Petraeus. Mm-hmm. Now, the truth of the matter is that violence dropped for other more important reasons, like the spread of the Anbar Awakening, the Shia decision to stand down attacks, sectarian separation of places like Baghdad, right? But still, what you have by 2008, 2009, especially looking to President Obama's first year in office, is this very, very powerful idea that, hey, the American military, especially the American Army, has figured out to do foreign occupations on the ground under a doctrine that has, at least ostensibly, a very moral purpose, which is protection of local populations, those kinds of things. So it made it seem like war was finally made to work.
Suddenly, the phone lines are open. That's how we know we only have about 6 minutes to go. The phone lines are full. Let's go to Mike in Dubuque, Iowa. Mike, good afternoon.
Hey, how you guys doing?
Hi, Mike.
Hey, I have one quick question, and I would like to preface it with, in the interest of full disclosure, I'm a nonviolent peace activist, and I've been arrested a couple dozen times all over the country for nonviolent direct action. I just wanted to question on the notion that it's a pretty popular notion in my circles, and I don't often get to ask a former general these types of questions. There's a popular notion that counterinsurgency efforts tend to create more terrorists and create more turmoil in conflicted areas of the world. And I was just wondering if the general could comment on that.
Colonel Gentile?
Thanks, Mike. Well, I think you can make the argument that it's what perhaps have produced more. I mean, look, there was no Al Qaeda in Iraq until the United States invaded, removed the regime, and then stayed to occupy. So I don't think it's so much counterinsurgency or no counterinsurgency. I think, at least in the specific case of Iraq, what produced Al Qaeda moving into Iraq was the American military occupation of that country.
Mm-hmm. Mike, thanks so much for that call. Let's go to Greg in Milwaukee next. Greg, thanks for joining us this afternoon. Go ahead.
Yes, I recently had a chance to look at a book by, I believe, Max Boot.
Yes.
Mm-hmm. With Secret Armies, History of Guerrilla Warfare.
Right, Invisible Armies.
Are you familiar with this book?
I sure am. I wrote a review of it a couple of months ago, Greg.
Okay. What I got from this book was that the guerrilla approach to resistance has defeated standing armies for thousands of years. Why would the United States get involved in an effort against with their standing army against a guerrilla resistance?
Okay, Greg, we're running out of time.
The damage of the United States.
Yeah, we're running out of time. Greg, Colonel, go ahead.
Yeah, I read Max's book. He and I were colleagues at the Council of Foreign Relations when I was a visiting fellow there a couple of years ago. I mean, it's a beautifully written book. I mean, the scope of the history that he includes in there is very, very impressive. The problem I have with the argument that Max makes in his book is that he lays out really extensively and very, very clearly a very, very deep and broad history of guerrilla warfare throughout the ages. And then he makes the point, basically, that since guerrilla warfare has been around so long, therefore we just have to face the fact that we're going to fight guerrillas in the future. I find that to be an over-determinist approach to good strategy. Whether or not certainly there are guerrillas out there in the world. Now, whether or not the United States needs to go fight those guerrillas is a question of strategy that should ultimately be linked to what our core vital interests are.
Greg, thanks so much for joining us and for your question this afternoon. Colonel, I know that we've touched on most of this already, but we're at the end of the hour, and I want to make sure that we get a good summary here. I mean, the title of your book suggests the takeaway that you want people to have, to understand that this has been a mistake. It hasn't worked the way it was supposed to. So instead of counterinsurgency, what should our military posture be, not just in Afghanistan, which we're in the process of leaving, but let's say that something like this comes up in the future? What should we be doing instead of counterinsurgency?
Yeah, I think, and I've tried to make this point, John, over and over again, and it's tied to the comment that Steve made about the British and strategy. What the United States should do is do good strategy, which ultimately sits in the middle between policy and the resources of war, like tactical military force, and then looks to see the interests of the United States are in the world and whether or not the application of American military power can accomplish and achieve those important interests at a reasonable cost in blood and treasure. I don't think if a state gets a passing grade for doing strategy like that in war, I don't think the United States has gotten a passing grade in Iraq and Afghanistan. And I think ultimately that doing good strategy needs to be premised on Andrew Bacevich's notion that there are limits to what American military power can accomplish in the world, especially if we think that the American military can put itself down on the ground and transform an entire society at gunpoint in a short amount of time.
Well, Colonel,
that the United States has taken, I think, John.
Okay. Colonel, thank you so much for your time. I know one thing that's now on my to-do list is to go back and reread von Clausewitz, but I appreciate your time this afternoon, and I enjoyed reading your book.
Thank you very much, John, for having me on the show.
Colonel Jean Gentile is the author of Wrong Turn, America's Deadly Embrace of Counterinsurgency. This program was produced by K.P. Whaley and Rhonda Fanning, and we also had production assistance today, if I can call it up on my screen, which just managed to disappear. Who was it? Oh, Jessica Sharpie. Thank you so much, Jessica, for your work. I'm John Munson. It's the Kathleen Dunn Show on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.